The Gospels, a commentary. Professor Anthony Frendel and Professor Peter Barsalo discuss excerpts from the Gospels. Readings by Patricia Camilleri. A reading taken from Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 to 12. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you."
So, Peter, we start our discussion once again, and our first text is very well known, actually. It's practically become a cliché, but still, if one looks closely at the text, one will certainly have some points to underscore. This passage is, as relayed by Matthew, is inserted in the so-called Sermon of the Mount. And obviously it has passed through the hands of Matthew and his school, and it has got a certain shape which fits into the overall pattern of the Gospel of St. Matthew. So, for example, Jesus is depicted as preaching this Magna Carta of Christianity on a mount, because Matthew wants to depict Jesus as the new Moses giving the new law. In fact, the Beatitudes as relayed in Matthew are showing Jesus preaching on a plain, which is the opposite of what we have here. Another thing is the structure. In the Gospel of St. Matthew, we have four Beatitudes and four woes, whereas here we have eight Beatitudes, because the last one is not really a Beatitude, it's a summary, so to say, of the condition of the disciples inserted by St. Matthew. So, as far as structure goes, we have two sets of four Beatitudes in this text. The first four indicate a note on righteousness as a gift of divine righteousness, whereas the second four are an appeal to the disciples of Jesus to be merciful, to be peacemakers, to be pure in heart. I don't know if you've got some comments to make, and then we can carry it over from there.
Yes, I'm struck by the fact that the mention is of a mountain, as you're saying. I mean, it links with Moses going up to the mountain and being in a superior position because of his special situation as a leader, as a chosen leader, handpicked by God, we have to say. And here we have this possibility of an analogy and a parallelism. But, of course, in geographical terms, when once you go to the Lake of Galilee over there, and Jesus is trying to move away from the crowd. The crowd are really desperate, wanting to touch him or be around him. The disciples have quite a job in settling them down. He is away aloof. At the same time, he is with them. And there is a sense of a congregation, a people in some kind of disarray, a flock without a shepherd almost, and he feels sorry for them at one stage, later on. and he's now giving them something to hope for. Not miracles, but spiritual food.
Exactly. In fact, what you say is so true, I think, that the introductory note of the passage we selected for today says that he sat down, which means he's a rabbi teaching, and the disciples are around him, and as you say, there's this closeness. So apart from Matthew's editorial point of emphasizing the mountain as being the point where the new law is given, there is this actual depiction of Jesus sitting like a rabbi. He's got to be seen as preaching and so on. Now, I think one of the intriguing points in this text is, in fact, the first beatitude. Much ink has been spilled, or modern terminology, many computer bytes have been invested in this poor in spirit. Now, previously people used to say, well, look, in the version of St. Luke, Jesus says, happy are the poor. Whereas in Matthew's version, he says, happy are the poor in spirit. So the next logical step was to say that Matthew wanted to emphasize the attitude behind what Jesus wanted to teach, namely an attitude of detachment, and it's not a question of whether one is poor or rich, but whether one is detached or not. Now, this is true, but the way to reach this conclusion is not completely true as it used to be depicted, because we nowadays know from Hebrew, from our new knowledge about Hebrew in the last centuries BC and first centuries AD, that this phrase, poor in spirit, was in fact an idiom in the Hebrew language. In other words, poor in spirit and poor are identical. Poor in spirit meant to depict, it was a phrase which was meant to depict those who are really poor and therefore are really crushed in spirit and therefore really need to depend on God. Obviously, Jesus wasn't making a sociological claim or a claiming poverty. He was taking the poor as an example of those who usually, although not always, depict, illustrate a dependence on God which even the rich must have. And apart from that, in Jesus' time, the Pharisees used to believe that the poor would be ousted from the kingdom of God, whereas Jesus says, no, on the contrary, they are happy and they are included. In fact, we have, from Qumran, the excavations of Qumran, one of the scrolls, the so-called war scroll, says, among the poor in spirit, then there is a reconstruction of the text, there is power over the hard of heart. So poor in spirit are the poor. Eventually, this idiom was turned into a metaphor, practically, for the pious, the one who depends on God. Another background to this is the prophet Isaiah, where in chapter 61, verse 1, we find the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, says my English text, although the original says meek. Now here we have a problem, because there are two Hebrew words which are very, very similar to each other, with slight nuances of difference, virtually none. And these two words are ana, ani, which means poor, needy, destitute, and anau, which means meek. It is obvious that the two words interrelate. In fact, in this passage from Isaiah, the Hebrew text says he has sent to bring good news to the meek, whereas the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the so-called Septuagint version, says to the poor. And so there is an overlap here. The main point being that it is a question of one's attitude in heart, of heart. And this is shown in Isaiah chapter 66. This is all the background to what Jesus was teaching. Isaiah chapter 66 verse 2 says, but this is the one to whom I will look, to the humble and contrite in spirit. And I think this in our Beatitude text is paralleled by the third Beatitude, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. I don't know if you've got some comments to make on this from the literary point of view.
Well, I must say, I mean, obviously I defer to your scholarship and to your knowledge of Hebrew. I must say, this perplexed me somewhat. Because the two versions, this is Matthew and Luke.
Yes.
In Luke, it's the poor, and I find myself shifting towards that meaning. After all, one imagines that the multitude around him were mainly poor people, looking upward through the shepherd, who's going to somehow, in some way, relieve them of their poverty, physical poverty, or perhaps the poverty of spirit, or whatever. The poor in spirit seems to me to give, if you're looking at it from the modern meaning now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is the way most readers will look at it. The poor spirit gives the sense that here even the rich are included, because it can be a very rich man, but a meek and humble man. And I think that in light of what Christ says later about the rich, that it's extremely difficult for them to enter the kingdom of heaven, the camel's eye and all that, I think that he really means the poor, you know, your condition. Do not in any way try to relieve your condition, because the poor man is stuck with poverty. It is part of him. His rags are his flesh. And what Christ is really saying, in my interpretation of it, is that your condition is your salvation.
Because of the internal attitude which it induces you.
Because of the internal attitude it induces.
That's why Luke uses this.
Yes.
Matthew uses this phrase.
Yes.
I think. And in fact, I wholly agree, because what I was trying to say was that the Qumran idiom has shown us that this in spirit is not an editorial trick by Matthew. It's a linguistic variant to underline the attitude which Jesus was praising in the poor, not so much because of their external poverty, but because of the condition which usually it induces them to.
Yes.
That's a
condition which is foisted on them by circumstance and which they meekly accept.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes.
And this is borne out, I think, by the parallel. So we've got in Matthew, Beatitude 1, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This is paralleled by, not the next one, but the third one. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. In a sense, there he's using meek as a synonym of what he means by poverty in spirit. I must say, Peter, that what you said is true. In a sense, we're saying the same thing in a different way, because there was an evolution, a linguistic evolution, in the Old Testament on this question of poverty. There were various Hebrew words, which I won't go into now, which meant poor, lowly, dependent, destitute. Then all of a sudden there appear texts in the later texts of the Old Testament where, for example, the poor, the opposite of needy in parallel texts is not the rich, but the violent. And therefore there is a linguistic evolution in which poor becomes practically a word which means pious. Why? Because of that external condition, man usually becomes dependent on God, and it is that dependence which is being praised. And the category of the really poor are chosen because they are the best example of the ones who usually, let's say 90% of the time, demonstrate this attitude which you were underscoring.
Yes, and of course later on you can see it in the parable of Dives and Lazarus.
Exactly, exactly.
And Lazarus goes to heaven. And Dives, of course, ends up in hell and wanting to somehow alleviate his condition. Can I just ask you, also, I wonder whether the word blessed
It's happy, basically.
It's happy,
yes,
isn't
the
it?
Old because Testament it's a translation.
Word
yes.
Too.
Yeah.
Happy are you?
Happy.
Be
would
happy.
Be, yes.
I think it's more happy.
Happy.
Than
in other words, don't be saddened, despite your condition, because
be happy in
the end,
your condition,
exactly,
because
it will open up.
It will open up the gates of heaven or hell.
Eschatologically.
Whereas
it.
Blessed presupposes something else.
Yes. In fact, where
semantically.
We, exactly. Where we have blessed here, probably if somebody were writing this in the Old Testament, would use the word asher, which ashrei or asher, which would mean happy.
Happy. Happy. I would imagine, because we're also reading from a modern text, aren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The readings are taken from a modern text.
Exactly.
And I would have thought that in a modern text, which changes certain words,
yes,
like council and to committee, That perhaps this might have been singled out.
Although the Greek might lead you to translate blessed, the idea behind it definitely, because the background is an Old Testament one, would be happy. Happy are they. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have, for example, parallels here. For example, in, let's say, the... I'm trying to find one where there is the peacemakers, for example. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. This echoes Psalm 34, verse 14, which says, seek peace and pursue it. And in that context, it is a man who will be happy. He will be blessed in the sense of he will be happy, he will be satisfied if he pursues peace. And I must say, these Beatitudes, as they are relayed here, part of them originally stem directly from Christ, as corroborated by the parallel text in Luke. Others are an expansion of Matthew, who doesn't invent them, but bases them on the general teaching of Jesus. So, for example, this thing of peacemakers, the merciful, the pure in heart. Again, pure in heart. Who are the pure in heart? This echoes Old Testament texts, where in the Psalms, for example, it says, who will enter into the temple of Yahweh? The answer, there's a refrain, it's a song. He who has clean hands and has got a pure heart, which means is single-minded, God-centered, and has no double motives. No ulterior.
A certain innocence.
Yes, a certain innocence.
Which, of course, Christ praised exactly. In children.
No ulterior motives.
You have to be like little
no
children.
No ulterior motives,
yeah.
Exactly. And I must say also that the first four Beatitudes, we are poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, and those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, are depicting a certain ideal situation where the disciple of Christ has to tend. He has to strive to be, let's say, poor in spirit. Whereas the other ones, the second bit, would describe the, in other words, the first is an ideal, which we have to strive for. The second one is a condition. Blessed are the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, and those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And in this text, the word righteousness has got a double meaning. In verse 6, it's people who strive for God's righteousness, God's being just, being correct, being in the right, being the one who justifies. Whereas in the second one, they are the ones who are striving themselves by God's gift to be righteous, to be on the right path, to be in the right order.
Yes. And I think there is, it moves from the general also to the particular.
Exactly.
Because, of course, those who suffer for my sake. So the general would be Yahweh, God, in the ideal, as you were saying, but also for my sake. So obviously, Christ is also looking into the future, seeing himself as being crucified, and then seeing the early Christians being persecuted.
Exactly.
And therefore, you know, your reward is going to be great because you have extolled me as the Messiah.
I think your interpretation is correct because it matches what the way Matthew understood the Beatitudes. Because in verse 11, as we said, there are four and four, so there are eight. The last one in verse 11 is not really a Beatitude which fits the, let's say, literary pattern, if I may say so. It's like a summary by Matthew himself, phrased in the same way as Christ would have phrased it. And Matthew understood the Beatitudes in a Christological manner, as you say, because this is where he comes up with, blessed are you when people persecute, revile you, and persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely, on my account. Which means he is the kingdom.
Yes.
Christ is the kingdom.
And at that moment in time, nobody had any idea that, nobody in the crowd had any idea that Christ was going to face a terrible death.
Exactly.
And that he was going to give his life to redeem the world. And therefore, it's a kind of recognition of Christ eventually. But those who recognize Christ, Christ will have to suffer for it.
Exactly. And he in a sense, becomes the kingdom.
He becomes the kingdom.
This is obviously an idea which had already been propagated by the fathers of the church, mainly Origen, for example. And I think if we look closely at the text, we'll see that not only because of parallelism, but even the way the Beatitudes are listed, they all are, in fact, an explicit specification of who the poor in spirit are. If one is poor in spirit in the sense in which you explained it, which you correctly deciphered it, then one is mourns because of his situation. He mourns, but he's comforted despite his external situation. He's the one who is meek, therefore unassuming. He is unassuming. He's the one who hungers and thirsts for righteousness. In other words, he seeks constantly to follow the path delineated by God. He is merciful, because God is merciful, and pure in heart, and he's a peacemaker. And I think, therefore, this fits perfectly.
From a narratological level, which interests me, if you look at it as a literary text, which is where my interest comes in, it's interesting to see what seems to be an objective account, which also contains within it, incorporates within it, a slight interpretation as it goes along.
Exactly.
And that is fascinating to see, and that is, of course, when you compare it, say, with Luke.
It's different because
it's similar but different.
They're basically saying the same thing.
Yes.
And everything in a sense is different, because what happens is, in the version of Luke, which if I recall correctly, is found in Luke chapter 17. Let me see that. No, that's wrong. I'll have to fish the text out. Anyway, in Luke, the Beatitudes are, first of all, four. There are four Beatitudes and four woes. What happened, you see, this is fascinating. The point which you mentioned is fascinating from a historical and exegetical point of view. In other words, from the also development of the tradition. I think we wouldn't be off point if we were to include in our discussion something which would be valid even for our later discussions on how the Gospels were formed. Obviously, you've got Christ at the origin, his works, deeds, and teachings, the oral tradition which transmitted these teachings, which was picked up by various disciples and their schools, such as Matthew. Matthew would have had an exegetical school at Antioch, most probably, and each one would have taken the common tradition and read it according to the points he wanted to emphasize. And so, for example, in Matthew we have four Beatitudes and four woes. What does Matthew do? He knows about those, he picks on those, he keeps the four Beatitudes, he takes the four woes, expands them, puts them in chapter 23 against the Pharisees, and in the Beatitudes section just leaves the Beatitudes expanded.
Yes,
I don't know if this...
No, yes, absolutely.
...fits from the narratological...
It does. In fact, this is something we can then discuss in future...
Exactly.
In future sessions.
By way of summary, I must say that it wouldn't be bad to remind ourselves that Christ's own teaching was heavily, wholly practically, based on Old Testament exegesis, which he perfectly knew. And this fundamental beatitude of poverty in spirit echoes, as I said before, the chapter of Isaiah, as the prophet Isaiah, chapter 61 and chapter 66. And I would urge the listeners to go and read those two chapters on their own. I have no time, but I just very quickly would like to read two verses to illustrate my point. Yes. Chapter 61, which speaks of the anointed one, the Messiah, the Spirit of the Lord. This is Isaiah chapter 61, verse 1. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, says my text. It should be meek, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and release to the prisoners. If we go now to chapter 66 in the same prophet, Isaiah chapter 66, there is an explanation of who these poor are. Chapter 66, verse 2, but this is the one whom I will look to. But this is the one to whom I will look, to the humble and contrite in spirit, who trembles at my word. Despite everything, at the end was a question of an attitude of heart.
Yes.
That is why Matthew chose the idiom, which is equivalent to the other one, but with slight different nuance, poor in spirit, because of the attitude.
That was Professor Anthony Frindall and Professor Peter Barsalo discussing the gospel passage chosen for today's commentary.